Welcome to El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine. International Federation of Clinical Chemistry, IFCC. Executive Director, Dr. Hernan Ferris Tayeb.
Member of the Committee of Evidence-Based Laboratory Medicine of the International Federation of Clinical Chemistry.
Organizing Committee, Dr. Maria Montserrat Blanes Gonzalez from Paraguay, Dr. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico, and Dr. Estela Raimondo from Uruguay.
El Microscopio. A program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry.
El Microscopio, where health professionals can meet over the internet.
We are thankful to the audience. We have more than 100,300 Facebook likes. Let's go for more.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
The Spanish Association of Pharmaceutical Analysts and the Chilean Society of Clinical Chemistry accompany El Microscopio.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Professor Graham Bissell is Professional Advisor on Laboratory Medicine for the UK Government Department of Health. He was the past president of the IFCC, the International Federation of Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine. Professor Bissell has published over 150 articles concentrating on biochemical endocrinology and evidence-based laboratory medicine.
Professor Graham Bissell, welcome to Microscopio.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me to contribute again to El Microscopio. Today, what I want to do is draw your attention to a new webinar that's been produced, which is entitled Medical Laboratory Accreditation. What is it and why is it important? This is a webinar that's been produced jointly by IFCC. I guess you're familiar with IFCC, but it's produced in combination with ILAC. And ILAC is the International Laboratory Accreditation Cooperation, which is the peak international authority on laboratory accreditation, and the members are accreditation bodies and stakeholders from around the world. Now, the webinar itself is available without charge on the IFCC eAcademy, and the link to the webinar will be provided close to my CV on the presentation. So let's start by asking the first question: what is laboratory accreditation? And laboratory accreditation is the independent assessment of the performance of a laboratory against an objective set of quality and competent standards. And ISO 15189-2012 represents the current global best practice standard. The accreditation to ISO 15189 involves the independent assessment of a laboratory, and it addresses a wide range of issues which are explained in detail in the webinar. If you're interested in laboratory accreditation, where do you begin? Well, the place to begin is by contacting your accreditation body, and you should start talking to them about your needs and expectations in regard to accreditation. If you're unsure where your accreditation body is, then you should contact ILAC, and details of how to do that are available in the webinar. Accreditation will require you to complete a number of assessments and provide a lot of data, and then the accreditation assessors will come and look to see if you have complied with the standards of ISO 15189, and an explanation is given about the accreditation process and laboratory accreditation assessors and what their role is. A large number of parameters are assessed as part of accreditation, and these are effectively the standards of ISO 15189, and these are explained in some detail in the webinar. Granting of accreditation depends on compliance with the specified criteria of the accreditation body, and a certificate of accreditation will be issued together with a scope of accreditation, which indicates the extent to which any one laboratory may be accredited. Well, that's fine in terms of what is laboratory accreditation. A lot more detail is available on the webinar. But perhaps the question that is often asked is, why is laboratory accreditation important? Why should labs be thinking about it in the first place? And that's because laboratory accreditation provides a benchmark of technical competence and high quality performance. And laboratory accreditation it's patient focused, it's impartial and it's objective, and it provides a mechanism for ongoing review and improvement. And crucially, laboratory accreditation against ISO 15189 is a global standard for accreditation, which is transferable anywhere in the world. Laboratory accreditation is important to a number of different stakeholder groups. And in the webinar, we look at each of these stakeholder groups in some detail. So the first stakeholder group for whom laboratory accreditation is important are patients and the public. And perhaps these are the most important audience of all, as far as the laboratory is concerned. They will appreciate that accreditation is important because of the consistency, the quality of care, the service is up to date, and the staff performing the service are competent to undertake the tasks that they perform. The next audience for whom laboratory accreditation is important are clinical users of the lab, and results from an accredited lab provide confidence and reassurance about quality, are clinically relevant, and help planning, investigations, and management. The third audience for whom laboratory accreditation is important are healthcare authorities and regulators. Because laboratory accreditation provides an independent assurance of quality and safety that supports world-class decisions on how to deliver better care and value for patients. And then finally, the fourth audience for whom laboratory accreditation is important are the laboratory management and the staff themselves, because accreditation provides proof that a laboratory complies with best practice, provides an opportunity for external perspectives on the lab performance, encourages a sharing of best practice, stimulates innovation, reduces risk, and very importantly, provides international recognition. So that's a very brief overview of what you can expect to find in the webinar that's been produced jointly by IFCC and ILAC. And I would encourage you to click on the link and enjoy the webinar in some detail. Thanks for the opportunity to share this brief presentation with you.
Thank you very much, Professor Bistol. It's always a pleasure to have you in Microscopio. The link to the presentation will be uploaded to our website together with this program. So we invite our audience to just click on it and visit this and read about this interesting presentation.
Okay, thank you.
El Microscopio, agenda, offering courses, workshops, seminars, congresses.
Agenda. 14th Asia Pacific Federation for Clinical Biochemistry and Laboratory Medicine Congress in Taipei, Taiwan, November 26, 2016.
El Microscopio.
The IFCC EFLM Euromed Lab 2017 in Athens, Greece, in June the 11th, 2017.
Agenda. El Microscopio.
The 23rd Colabiocli Congress 2017 and the 11th Uruguayan Congress of Clinical Biochemistry in Punta del Este, Uruguay, in September 17, 2017.
Agenda.
23rd IFCC World Lab 2017 in Durban in South Africa on October 22, 2017.
El Microscopio.
The 20th Congress of Medical Biochemistry and Laboratory Medicine in Belgrade, Serbia on May 25, 2016.
El Microscopio.
The 12th EFLM Symposium for Balkan Region in Belgrade, Serbia on May 26, 2016.
Agenda.
The 4th Joint EFLM-UEMS Congress Laboratory Medicine at the Clinical Interface in Warsaw, Poland on September 21st, 2016.
Follow your memory upstream.
mountain where we counted every falling star. I believe the light that shines on you will shine on you forever. And though I can't guarantee there's nothing scary hiding, stand guard like a postcard of a golden retriever, and never leave till I leave you with a sweet dream in your head. I'm gonna watch you shine, gonna watch you grow, gonna paint a sign so you'll always know. As long as could never be a father love his daughter more than I love you. Trust your intuition, it's just like going fishing. You cast your line and hope you get a bite. But you don't need to waste your time worrying about the marketplace. Try to help the human race struggling to survive its harshest night. I'm gonna watch you shine, gonna watch you grow, gonna paint a sign so you'll always know. As long as one and one is two, there could never be a father love his daughter more than I love you. I'm gonna watch you shine, gonna watch you grow, gonna paint a sign so you'll always know. As long as one and one is two, ooh, there could never be a father love his daughter more than I love mine.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world, our correspondents in every country. Alberto Barrantes in Costa Rica. Álvaro Justiniano Gross in Bolivia. Ana Leticia Maceli in Guatemala. Carmen Cecilia Almonacid Urrego in Colombia. Cristina Cerveto from Uruguay. Eduardo Aranda in Chile. Graciela Velázquez from Paraguay. María del Carmen Pasquel from Ecuador.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
This is the second announcement for the IFCC World Lab Durban 2017, the Congress about the Multi-Omics and Laboratory Medicine. The IFCC World Lab is in Durban, in South Africa. It is the 23rd International Congress of Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine, the 57th meeting of the South African Association for Clinical Laboratory Medicine, and the 5th Congress of the African Federation of Clinical Chemistry. It will be held in Durban, South Africa, from the 22nd to the 25th of October 2017, at Durban International Convention Center. For more information, we invite you to check www.durban2017.org.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Professor Ronald van Rijck is a researcher at the Radboud Institute for Molecular Life Sciences in the Netherlands. He was also an assistant professor and associate professor at that institute.
So, Professor Ronald van Rijck, welcome to Microscopio.
Thank you.
In this interview, we wanted to talk about red dengue virus. And our first question is, What is dengue virus and how is it transmitted?
The dengue virus is obviously a virus. It's from a family called flaviviruses. It's an RNA virus, which means that in the viral particle, there's one single strand of RNA. And the virus exists as globally as four serotypes, dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4, with a different, little bit of a different distribution across the globe. And importantly, this virus is transmitted by mosquitoes, and it's two species of mosquitoes mainly, Aedes albopictus and Aedes aegypti. And so without mosquitoes, there's no transmission of this particular virus. And so the name of these sort of viruses is called arthropod-borne viruses, or short, arboviruses.
What is the cycle of the life of the mosquito?
Okay, so the, like I guess many mosquitoes, Aedes mosquitoes develop from eggs into larvae, and so the eggs are laid in fresh water. And so the larvae develop, there's a few larval stages, and then it pupates, so it becomes a pupae still in the water, and then the larvae develops into an adult mosquito, which then can emerge, and then have their adult life cycle as a mosquito as we know it. Females do feed on blood. Males feed mostly on nectar from flowers. And once the male and the female mate, they will the female will lay an egg raft in the water again, and so the cycle continues. And so the particular mosquitoes that transmit dengue virus, the Aedes mosquitoes that I referred to earlier, they like to lay their eggs in still standing fresh water, and they love to feed on humans, and so they usually also live in close proximity to humans, and this is why this particular mosquito is such a good transmitter of arboviruses, like dengue virus.
And what happens when a mosquito becomes infected? Does the mosquito become sick from the infection?
Yeah, that's interesting, because it seems so that when the mosquito takes a blood meal of somebody who's infected with dengue, and there's high levels of dengue in this particular infected person, the mosquito becomes infected with the virus, and funnily enough, the mosquito doesn't really suffer from it. So the virus replicates first in the gut, and then it escapes to the hemolymph, which is sort of the blood of the mosquito. It spreads through the body of the mosquito, and then it reaches the salivary glands. And there, the virus replicates further until there's very high levels of virus. And when the mosquito takes a blood meal in a new non-infected person, then the virus can be transmitted. And so apparently the mosquito doesn't really suffer so much from the infection. We think that it is because mosquitoes have actually also a sort of an immune system against these viruses, which is actually a very interesting system that we study in our lab as well. And it's called RNA interference. And it seems that that system recognizes the viral RNA and then degrades it into small chunks. And so this immune system of the mosquito contributes to, probably contributes to the fact that these mosquitoes don't get really sick. Nevertheless, they cannot fully clear the virus. So that is why the infection can be transmitted again to a next person. So it's a very interesting dynamics. And we study this immune system of the mosquito in detail because we'd like to understand whether there's any possibilities to interfere with the transmission.
What are the signs and symptoms of dengue virus disease?
Yeah, so the symptoms are... there's many different symptoms, and they're not super specific, so that makes it also very hard to sort of recognize an infection as specifically a dengue virus infection. And so usually after being infected, day of 4 or 5 after infection, there can be symptoms like fever, headaches, pain behind the eyes, joint pain, muscle pain, nausea, vomiting, and so quite so sort of general symptoms in a way. And in some cases, and it's only a minority of the cases, there can be more severe symptoms like more severe internal bleedings and shock. And this sort of infections are called dengue shock syndrome. And so it is a very severe infection, and it is very highly prevalent across the globe. Fortunately, the really severe cases are still a minority.
And is there any treatment for dengue virus? Is there any vaccine?
No, so there's no, let's say, typical antiviral drugs that directly target the virus. So if somebody gets infected, there's not really, there's a person can be supported with liquids, and there can be pain relievers can be given, like paracetamol. But for the rest, it's taking rest, drinking enough fluids, and then if it doesn't proceed into a very severe infection, usually the infection recovers. As to a vaccine, there's no vaccine available yet. Trials are ongoing in which several new vaccine candidates are tested, but for now, there's no actual vaccine for this particular virus. And so the best way to prevent yourself from being infected is actually quite simply prevent being bitten by this mosquito.
Could you please tell us something about your recent publication on antiviral compounds against dengue virus?
Yeah, sure, I would love to. Yeah, so this is a large part of our lab is working on, let's say, this immune system of the mosquito, but another part of my lab is actually pursuing finding compounds that inhibit dengue virus. And so this is still very much lab work, so we're very far from any applications. But what we have done is we in our recent publication in Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, we're describing that actually an derivative of paracetamol, a metabolite of paracetamol, this metabolite is called AM404, is actually able to inhibit replication of dengue virus in cells.
And how did you identify the compound?
So we found this particular compound in actually a high throughput screen. So what we did was we have a dengue virus derivative that expresses luciferase, which you can easily measure in the lab. We treated the cells that carry this particular virus with a library of small compounds, about a few hundred of them. And these compounds are called the clinical collection, and is provided by the National Institute of Health of the USA. And these compounds have been used previously in humans for other diseases or in other clinical trials. And so our hope was that by screening this library, we would find inhibitors of dengue virus. And since they have been used in already in humans, that these compounds already are safe for use. And so we screened this particular luciferase expressing dengue virus, and we asked for each compound, okay, does this inhibit dengue virus or not? Does this one inhibit dengue virus or not? And from the screen, we found a few compounds that indeed inhibited dengue virus replication. And one of them that we described now in our recent paper is this molecule called AM404. And we find that it's inhibiting replication of this virus that expresses the luciferase gene, but also to some extent the wild-type virus, so the normal virus. Although I have to say that there's clearly inhibition of replication. It's not super strong. So this is not a particular drug that is going to be probably not going to be used as an actual drug in the clinic. So this is basically the first step in this in identifying new inhibitors.
So you found in your publication that the virus can become resistant to the drug. Why is this important?
Yeah, so AM404 has many different activities in the cell. And so we wanted to understand a little bit better how it works and how it inhibits the virus. It's not so trivial to find out exactly the mechanism how this particular compound inhibits the virus. We think it's not directly binding viral proteins, but we think it's affecting the cell in such a way that the virus doesn't replicate so well. So I think this compound inhibits a particular pathway that the virus needs to amplify itself, to replicate. And so as an alternative, we try to raise resistant viruses. So we culture the virus in the presence of this drug, and we hope to find mutants that are not sensitive to the drug anymore. And so we found them. That tells you, of course, that if this would be a drug used in humans, that resistance could occur. So that is, of course, a problem. But from a scientific point of view, it's interesting because we found where the resistant mutations are located. And we found that they are located in a gene. It's called NS4B, which is not a very well understood protein of the virus. But the fact that we find mutations in NS4B that confer resistance to this compound suggest that this protein is an indirect target for AM404. And so that means that NS4B may be a good target for drug development. And this is also in line with previous work of another group from Payong Shi, who's also found new inhibitors for dengue virus that actually target NS4B. And this is actually quite new, because most antiviral drugs thus far from other viruses target either the polymerase enzyme or the protease enzyme. And so this is an enzyme that is not enzymatic like those, and still it seems to be a good target for drug development.
So is that your next step in your publication, in your research? What is the next step in your line of research?
Yeah, we would love to know how AM404 is inhibiting dengue virus. Because if we understand that particular mechanism, so if we know how this compound is inhibiting the virus, we know a little bit more about the molecular biology of the virus, what is needed for the virus to replicate, but also if we identify a particular cellular pathway as being responsible for the antiviral effects, we think that we could also those could also be targets for new drug development. So that is where we want to go with this particular line of research. And of course, as I said before, also the work on the small RNA, so RNA interference as an antiviral pathway in mosquitoes, is something that we're pursuing in great detail.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure to have you in Microscopio.
Okay, well, my pleasure.
All right, well, thank you very much. We really appreciate your participation.
El Microscopio.
IFCC affiliates with Clinica Chimica Acta, the CCA, as the official journal of IFCC. The IFCC is delighted to be able to partner with Elsevier in agreement that makes Clinica Chimica Acta the official journal of IFCC. Elsevier has an outstanding reputation as an international publisher in the field of medicine and healthcare, with a huge range of leading titles in both journals and books. This experience will be of benefit to IFCC as we strive to increase our scientific and public relations image at a global level. In reaching the agreement, IFCC was encouraged by the vision and the commitment of Elsevier to advance the quality and impact of IFCC publications. In the years to come, Elsevier and CCA will continue to do their best to facilitate and publicize IFCC activities to enable the Federation to be as effective as possible. As part of this agreement with IFCC, all individual members of IFCC full and affiliate national societies will now be entitled, from the beginning of 2014, to receive low-cost online access to the journal, including archives back to the first issue in 1956. The coordination of this member subscription of $35 per year will be carried out by each society on behalf of its members. More details will be sent shortly to the IFCC National Society representatives.
Rumors of his health are lies. This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world. Our correspondents in every country. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico. José Jara from Peru. Milagros de la Rosa from Dominican Republic. Miriam Aguilera from Honduras. Rafael Calafel from Spain. Mario Chavez Villalobos from Costa Rica. Dante Yáñez from Bolivia. Leverton Ortiz from Chile.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
José Eduardo Levy is a professor of microbiology at the University of São Paulo in Brazil. In this interview, we're going to talk about the latest findings in Zika virus.
José Eduardo Levy, welcome to El Microscopio.
Thank you.
In this interview, we wanted to talk about Zika virus. What is Zika and why is it related to dengue virus and chikungunya?
Zika is a flavivirus. It's not new to science. It was discovered in the 40s in Africa. But from the 40s up to 2008 or 2007, there were only a few cases described in literature. So it was not well studied. And then there was this big outbreak in the Pacific Islands. And then it reached Brazil in 2015, and all that knowledge about Zika started to be built from that. And it was, of course, the most important feature was the link to microcephaly that made the virus famous for. The connection to dengue and to chikungunya, first, to dengue, in fact, Zika is very close to dengue, so they both belong to the Flaviviridae family. And chikungunya, it doesn't belong to the same family. It's far distant from dengue and Zika. But they are commonly put together and grouped because they all are transmitted to humans by a mosquito. So they may be called arboviruses, which is a common word. It's not a scientific classification, but it's a word to describe viruses that are transmitted by arthropods, and mainly mosquitoes and ticks.
And what is behind the propagation of this virus?
So the propagation is mainly driven by mosquitoes, or 99.9% by mosquitoes, and this is something also interesting and new about Zika, that it has been proven and
now science accepts it, that it may also be spread and transmitted by sexual contact. This is quite new. We didn't think that dengue may be transmitted this way, or West Nile virus is another flavivirus also transmitted by mosquito. So new sources and new kinds of transmission have been described for Zika that were not described for the other flaviviruses before. So Zika looks like it's more transmissible because it can be transmitted by distinct biological fluids, at least by the semen. It's well documented. And also the maternal-fetal transmission is important, of course.
And could you please tell us about the cycle of life of this mosquito?
So the mosquito that transmits Zika is several species from the Aedes, genus. And these mosquitoes, especially Aedes aegypti, is very, very well adapted to live in close proximity to human beings. And this is the most important feature of this mosquito, because being living so in close contact to humans, it has adapted to human behavior and to human houses and to these small sources of water that we keep in our houses, in our homes. And these mosquitoes learn how to reproduce in close proximity to us. So the cycle is, and this Aedes also was spread by humans since a long time ago. So the Spanish and Portuguese navigators brought this to the Americas, these mosquitoes. And also they took it from Africa and brought it to the Americas. And now it's spread almost all over the world. It was restricted to the tropical areas of the world, but now, possibly due to global warming, it is becoming more and more, it's going north and south, more and more to the north and to the south. And we can say that it was described, it was detected in Japan, it's already in Japan, it's already in Argentina, and in more colder areas that didn't have this mosquito 30, 40 years ago, it was absolutely not in there, and now it's present in all these areas. So all these areas now that where the Aedes is found are prone to epidemics of all these arboviruses, and especially of Zika. And the mosquito cycle is also enhanced and faster when you have warmer temperatures. So in principle, the female mosquito needs to suck the blood of a mammal or a bird. And those Aegypti species, they specialize it to suck the blood from humans, but they can do the same with monkeys and also pets. And they use this blood to have an energy source to lay their eggs. They always have to lay the eggs in the water. And then after 1 week, the eggs will hatch, give birth to the larva, and then the larva will in 1 week become an adult and start to fly. It's a it will metamorphize into an adult form, that is the flying mosquito. And then males and females will couple during the flight, and then the fertilized female closes the cycle. The whole cycle will take about 1 month to happen. But if you have warmer temperatures, it can be in 15 days you can have from egg to a new adult being born. So, of course, the link to the global warming and to warmer temperatures is quite clear.
And what are the symptoms and of this disease, of this virus, sorry? What are the symptoms of this virus?
All three viruses, but mainly Zika, is the degree of asymptomatic carriers is very high. So for dengue, we believe, and there is very strong scientific evidence, that for each symptomatic person, you have another two asymptomatic, completely asymptomatic infections. For Zika, we believe that for each symptomatic, we have another four. So the degree of, so Zika is less harmful and less symptomatic than dengue. And for chikungunya, it looks like it's 1-to-1. So chikungunya will be the most symptomatic of the three. And the symptoms they are mixed, so it's difficult to do a clinical diagnosis of the particular virus, especially in a situation like we have now in Brazil, where we have the co-circulation of all three viruses. It's difficult to do the diagnostics in a clinical basis because they share many symptoms. Fever is the most obvious and most common, but also we have the macropapular, forgot the word in English for that, but this is spots, that red spots that you find in the skin of the infected person, macropapular lesions, that also you can find them in the three infections, but it's very, very common and characteristic for Zika. And then you have the myalgia, it's a pain in the muscles, and arthralgia, it's a pain in the joints, that are more common in dengue and chikungunya than in Zika. And dengue is the only one that presents hemorrhagic features, so you lose or you bleed a lot externally or internally in a dengue infection, but there is no blood coagulation disturbed for the Zika virus infection.
And is there any treatment available nowadays?
No. So no specific treatment. Of course, there is a treatment, and the treatment is common to all three because we don't have a drug against the virus. We only treat the symptoms, and basically is to hydrate and to keep the person hydrated, and also to rest. And basically, those are the two things. And those that present an aggravation of the symptoms need to be followed in an intensive care unit or emergency unit, but need to be hospitalized. So these are where they can get reposition of water or fluids by having serum replacement. And maybe blood transfusions may be needed as well. But there is no specific treatment so far.
And if we have a patient suspected of having Zika virus, let's say, what is the laboratory test that is currently used to identify the virus?
Okay, so this is something that is very peculiar for these three viruses, and also for West Nile, which is prevalent in the US and Canada and now reaching Europe as well, is that you don't have one golden bullet. You don't have one test that will solve the problem and make the diagnostics for all patients or suspicious cases. What you have is tools or different methods that are better in each in one of the phases of the disease. So during the acute phase of the disease, when a person has fever, the best test is the molecular test. So where you detect the nucleic acids from the viruses. Mainly PCR is the name of the test, so polymerase chain reaction. It's a molecular test, and it has a very, very good sensitivity and specificity. But it has to be done during the symptomatic phase. When the patient is to the end tail of the symptomatic phase and beginning of the convalescent phase, the detection of IgM, so it's an antibody that's present on the blood of the suspicious patient, then this is the best test, IgM, because it will be positive in the positive case, it will be positive in over 99% of the cases. So these are the two options we have for the moment. IgM will remain positive for 2-3 months after the end of symptoms, and PCR is the best test, but it's only positive during the symptomatic phase, which lasts 5 days for Zika, up to 10 days for dengue, almost the same for chikungunya.
You have designed a new method. Perhaps you explained some part in this answer, but what are the characteristics of the new method you have developed in your laboratory to identify the virus?
Okay, so my lab is in a blood bank here. The São Paulo blood bank is the largest blood bank in Brazil. It's a public blood bank. And we attend a number, not a large number, but there is a number of pregnant women that for different reasons will need a blood transfusion. So in our reasoning, we thought that would be safer and would be a safety, a precautionary measure to test the blood for Zika before transfusing into this specific group of pregnant women, for obvious reasons now. And so for us, we don't have this option to do an IgM test. We need to detect the virus if it's present in the blood. So what we developed was a specific PCR method that is able to cope with the timelines and urgencies of a blood bank, meaning that it has to be very sensitive, but also fast. And then we took a protocol from CDC, which recommends the specific reagents that would be recommendable to be used for Zika. We adapted to our laboratory, our environment, and now we have a test that we can test about 30 blood bags per day in 5 hours. So we can keep on the shelf Zika-free or Zika-tested blood units, because no one knows when a pregnant woman will need a blood bag. So we have to keep them tested and ready to go in the shelf.
Right. And is there any final comment you would like to make about this topic?
Which topic? The whole Zika thing?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think it's a very difficult moment for this, also exciting for scientists like us, especially those that live in Brazil or in Latin America now, the endemic area. So in one side, we have a lot of worries and preoccupation from the public, some hysteria as well. And also we live in the era of information. So information circulates very fast. There is a lot of information, some good information with good evidence, and some information that does not help and always generate a lot of noise. So part of our duty now as scientists is try to put some rationale in the debate, to transmit this, what we know and what we don't know, to the general public in order to avoid extreme measures, and so to adopt what is reasonable and not to do what doesn't need to be done, and not to spare the resources doing things that don't have scientific basis. So it's both exciting. It's something that at the same time is a shame for us in Brazil. It's a shame for humanity, but especially for us, to be facing diseases transmitted by mosquitoes, which were, in fact, eradicated from Brazil in the 50s. And now we have this burden of mosquito-borne diseases. And unfortunately, Zika brings this microcephaly, which is a horrible feature of the disease that no one predicted before. So now we have all these cases of children with microcephaly in the country. So it's been an interesting moment, very sad at the same time, but also very pushing for us as scientists, and important for us to help the government and help the people to fight against this disease.
Well, thank you very much for this very interesting interview. It's been a pleasure to have you in Microscopia.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
This is the second announcement for the IFCC World Lab Durban 2017, the Congress about the Multi-Omics and Laboratory Medicine. The IFCC World Lab is in Durban, in South Africa. It is the 23rd International Congress of Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine, the 57th meeting of the South African Association for Clinical Laboratory Medicine, and the 5th Congress of the African Federation of Clinical Chemistry. It will be held in Durban, South Africa, from the 22nd to the 25th of October 2017, at Durban International Convention Center. For more information, we invite you to check www.durban2017.org.
This is El Microscopio.
On infobioquimica.org. News. The task force of giant scientists, a guide to conducting research in laboratory medicine. The aim of the guide to conducting research in laboratory medicine is to provide insight into the research process and to provide an overview of strengths and weaknesses of different research methods for young scientists at various levels of their professional career. The guide can be downloaded from the IFCC website, and we invite our audience to have a look at it.
About it, let me tell you about my love, brought to me by an angel from above, fully equipped with a lifetime guarantee. Once you try it, well, I'm sure that you'll agree. Without love, there's no reason to live. Without you, what would I do with the love I give? All my love to you I'll be giving, and I promise as long as I'm living. I'm thinking of you and the things you do to me that make me love you. Now I'm living in ecstasy. I'm thinking of you and the things you do to me that make me love you. Now I'm living in ecstasy. Helping me survive. What did you think about the sun up today? Well, it's you. But let me hear you say, without love, there's no reason to live. Without you, what would I do with the love I give? All my loving to you I'll be giving, and I promise, as long as I'm living. I'm thinking of you and the things you do to me that make me love you. Now I'm living in ecstasy. I'm thinking of you and the things you do to me that make me love you. Now I'm living in ecstasy.
Microscopia, an online radio program about biochemistry.
Epidemiological report. Dengue fever is caused by any of four closely related viruses or serotypes, dengue 1-4. Infection with one serotype does not protect against the others, and sequential infections put people at greater risk for dengue hemorrhagic fever, DHF, and dengue shock syndrome, DSS. Dengue is transmitted between people by the mosquitoes Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, which are found throughout the world. Insects that transmit disease are vectors. Symptoms of infection usually begin begin 4 to 7 days after the mosquito bite and typically last 3 to 10 days. In many parts of the tropics and subtropics, dengue is endemic, that is, it occurs every year, usually during a season when Aedes mosquito populations are high, often when rainfall is optimal for breeding. These areas are, however, additionally at periodic risk for epidemic dengue when large numbers of people become infected during a short period. Dengue epidemics require a coincidence of large numbers of vector mosquitoes, large numbers of people with no immunity to one for four virus types, and the opportunity for contact between the two. Although Aedes are common in the southern hemisphere, dengue is endemic in northern Mexico and the US. Today, about 2.5 billion people, or 40% of the world's population, live in areas where there is a risk of dengue transmission. Dengue is endemic in at least 100 countries in Asia, the Pacific, the Americas, Africa, and the Caribbean. The World Health Organization estimates that 50 to 100 million infections occur yearly, including 500,000 DHF cases and 22,000 deaths, mostly among children. Information taken from the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, www.cdc.gov.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world, our correspondents in every country. Stella Raimondo from Uruguay, Fernando Ruiz Cerda from Chile, Montserrat González from Paraguay, Isabel Fierro from Ecuador, José Francisco Valle from Mexico, Oswaldo Ruiz Narváez from Costa Rica, Patrocinio Truecas from Spain, Rodolfo Aquino Cáceres from El Salvador.
Walk on out the door. Our hearts are strong and our hearts are